The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of The Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. During the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler, the News and Observer, and AAA Go magazine. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to conclude our three-part series, Best of the World, Where to Go in 2018, from the December 2017, January 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Already, we have visited seven places chosen best for culture and seven places best for city life. Today, we're going to visit seven locations best for nature. Like parts one and two, we're going to highlight the first six locations, and then we'll spend more time at our seventh and final destination. Writers Mary Ellen Kennedy Duckett and Andrew Evans provide details for our first six places considered best for nature, with wild experiences in the great outdoors. And before we begin, we must remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the expeditions or trips that may be mentioned. We merely seek to let you enjoy learning more about our world and its fascinating places and people. So let's begin. And we're going to start in Madagascar. And why go now? Well, leap for lemurs. Madagascar makes memories unlike anywhere else on Earth. The world's fourth largest island, located in the Indian Ocean, about 300 miles east of Mozambique, split from India about 88 million years ago. Being a continental castaway allowed Madagascar's plants and animals to evolve in a relative bubble. A mind-boggling 90% of its plant and animal life exists only here. Among the homegrown bunch, the lemur plays a starring role. Roughly 100 species of the nimble primates are found on Madagascar, and almost all are endangered due to widespread deforestation, climate change, and other threats. Join a 2018 Madagascar Wildlife Expedition with the National Geographic NatGeoExpeditions.com, where you have more information online, to learn about conservation efforts and see lemurs leaping through the treetops of Andasibe, Matadia, and Ranomafana National Parks. And by the way, there is a connection to the triangles, if you may have heard or have seen some articles or television stories about the lemur studies over at Duke University. So there is a tie there, and they actually go to Madagascar and do more studies there. So we have a connection. Well, next stop is the Jordan Trail, and why go now? Hike a newly marked historic route. Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad all walked this path, followed by generations of nomads, merchants, crusaders, and pilgrims. Today, the newly minted 404-mile Jordan Trail transects a modern-day kingdom in eight separate sections. Linking ancient trade routes, the Jordan Trail cuts through the mystery of the Middle East, leading travelers through flowering forest, deep stone canyons, and ruddy deserts, culminating at the turquoise shores of the Red Sea. Along the way, hikers explore Greek and Roman ruins, impressive biblical sites like Mount Nebo, the Ottoman outpost of Dana, the UNESCO World Heritage Site of Petra, and the strangely Martian landscape of Wadi Rum. Camels and towering castles add a fairy tale ambiance straight from the pages of the Arabian Nights, while hikers get a true taste of boundless Jordanian hospitality in village homestays, friendly guest houses, and Bedouin campsites lit by flickering candles and a thousand stars. The trail has a power over all those who walk it, says through hiker Mona Haddad, who completed the trek in 44 days. He notes, you surrender to the stories that it evokes. Well, that puts us in touch with our next stop, and that's going to be the Sihanoukville National Park, South Korea. And why go now? Well, aim for Olympic heights. When South Korea hosts its first Winter Olympic Games in February, the gold medal for jaw-dropping settings will go to the host province, Gangwon. About 70% of Korea's peninsula is covered in mountains, and Gangwon in South Korea's northeast is one of the most mountainous. While not an Olympic venue, the province's Sihanoukville National Park is a peak performer. In fact, the UNESCO Biosphere Preservation District encompasses 30 peaks, with Mount Sirok, or Sihanoukville, Korea's third highest mountain, topping out at around 5,600 feet. To see the heights, the park, and the Sea of Japan all in one swoop, ride the Sea of Rock cable car up to Gwanggu Minsong Fortress, the ruins of a 13th century castle. Number 18 is Ruaha National Park, Tanzania. And why go now? See lions to help save them. Ruaha National Park is where the wild things are and where hordes of safari goers are not. Located in central Tanzania, the country's largest park is home to about one-tenth of the world's threatened African lions. Few tourists and a relatively untouched landscape boost opportunities to spot the big cats, some grouped in supersized prides of 30 or more. Seeing a lion in the wild is one of the most inspiring and incredible experiences you can have, says Amy Dickman, director and founder of the grassroots Ruaha Carnivore Project, which promotes sustainable wildlife management in and around the park. There is nothing like that moment when a lion looks up from close by and looks at you. Then on to Albania. Yep, and why go now? Dive into an underwater treasure trove. In Albania, it's still possible to boldly go where few tourists have gone before. Decades of isolation under Stalinist leader Enver Hoxha kept most development at bay. As a result, areas such as Butrint National Park, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, with its sunken aqueducts and shipwrecks, remained relatively untouched. Off the southern Albanian coast, Hoxha inadvertently preserved underwater cultural heritage and coastal ecology by banning scuba diving to prevent people from escaping. As a cave diver, I have explored virgin caves that no one has ever dived in, a rarity in many parts of the world, says underwater archaeologist Peter Campbell of the Albania Center for Marine Research. Diving tourism remains uncommon, but an underwater sculpture park for divers, snorkelers, and glass-bottom boats is in the works. And then it's on to, Huwu Province, Argentina. In Argentina's geographically spectacular stratified Huwa Province, saddle up to a Peruvian Paso horse and ride into the sunset-like landscape. Outfitters include Ampasachi, horse riding holidays, which offers an eight-day trek, in case you're interested. And why go now to this kind of a unique little place? Well, Huwai is basically a roll with the rainbow rocks, as the writers tell us. Nature-made rock stars are the main stage attraction in remote Huwai Province. And located in the outermost limits of northwest Argentina, Huwai is home to the visually stunning Quebrada de Humahuaca, a narrow mountainous range valley and UNESCO World Heritage Site. A colorful geological quilt crafted over millennia cloaks the landscape. Elevate your Instagram with sunrise or sunset shots of the multi-hued rock bands, including pinks, whites, purples, reds, oranges, and browns, tinting Cerro de los Siete Colores, Hill of Seven Colors, and Paleta del Pintor, Painter's Palette in Mimara. Quite an interesting place, and definitely bone up in your Spanish to make sure you can get the right directions when you go there, huh? Well, for our final destination, we're going to turn to writer Christopher Harl's article, Oahu, Paradise Restored, going back to the land on Hawaii's most delicious island. The lychees look alien, like alien gumballs, in fact. Spiky and mottled red, they dangle in thick clusters from the tree in front of me. All around on this hillside farm, mangoes ripen by the thousands on long, arching branches, and squadrons of avocados hang fat and heavy overhead. Citrus, papayas, figs, breadfruit. I've spotted them all, along with a jackfruit the size of a soccer ball. And in the distance, at the far fringe of the broad Waialua district, I see a turquoise ocean fronting the fabled big wave surf beaches on Oahu's north shore. Being out here a couple of hours makes you feel you're going to live another 20 years, says Wendy Gaddy, who has been showing me around Poamoho Organic Farm on a May afternoon. I pick a lychee, flick off the top of its red husk, and gently squeeze until the white fruit inside pops into my mouth. Full of juice with a startling hit of sweet, tangy, and floral flavors, it is nothing like the canned lychees I've encountered in Chinese restaurants. It may be, I think, a taste of paradise. If so, it is a paradise regained through hard work, determination, and a vision to heal the Aina, the land of Hawaii. Though Pumoho Farm feels like a primordial Eden, a place where bounty has always been there for the picking. In fact, these fruit trees were planted only 15 years earlier, after more than a century of intensive sugarcane cultivation, and Waialua left the island exhausted. This certified organic orchard represents one response to a question posed in recent years across the islands. Now that cheaper overseas competition has killed off Hawaii's once prodigious sugar industry, the last commercial mill closed in December 2016, what becomes of the hundreds of thousands of acres formerly planted in sugarcane? Real estate developers have their own answers, but local communities and those alarmed that Hawaii imports a staggering 92% of its food passionately advocate for diversified agriculture and open space. I've known about this issue for more than three decades, ever since the first of many visits to these islands I've come to love deeply. It seems especially critical on Oahu, home to nearly 1 million of the state's 1.4 million residents. As houses, malls, and resorts sprout on former sugarcane closer to sprawling Honolulu, the sentiment of the farmers, New Age hippies, surfers, and other rural-loving folk who live on the North Shore a mere 30 miles away is succinctly stated on the bumper stickers and T-shirts you often spot up here. Keep the country country. Selling its produce to grocery stores and white tablecloth restaurants alike, 7-acre Pumoho Farm is a small but exciting success story in the North Shore's post-plantation evolution, an embracing of what generations of native Hawaiians have called Melama Aina, respect for the land. Although Gaddy is relatively a recent arrival on Oahu, she married a local guy. As the daughter of a fifth-generation Iowa farmer, she has the concept ingrained. To me, she says it boils down to taking care of the land for future generations. But with some 17,000 acres of sugarcane having once grown on the North Shore, around 12,000 of them in Waialua alone, I wonder at the effort it will take to bring new life to this sublime corner of earth and to preserve its rural ways. I think about my own experience earlier in the day after arriving in Honolulu on a long flight from San Francisco. Driving north, I literally breathed easier as layers of urban congestion peeled away, leaving the views of mountains, coffee orchards, and fields of pineapple and alfalfa. A scant 40 minutes after leaving Honolulu, I was standing in Gaddy's little slice of heaven. Will future Oahuans and visitors to this island be able to do the same? The sun has barely risen as I poke along a sandy shore, a mug of strong coffee in hand and the Pacific lapping on my toes. It's my first morning in Oahu, the day after my visit to Pumoho Farm, and dawn is proving a hushed, seductive time on the North Shore. The crowds of day trippers won't materialize for hours to gape at the waves of Sunset Beach and Waimea Beach, not so huge now that winter is over, or to the lineup for a food truck shrimp lunch or a shave ice at Matsumoto's. The nighttime perfume of flowering plumera tree still hangs in the air, and dew dappens beaches pockmarked with excavations of nocturnal horn-eyed ghost crabs. Though I'm ostensibly on a walk to spot Honu, the Hawaiian green sea turtles that frequent these waters, any gaze keeps wandering Mauka toward the land and Waianae Range running along one side of Waialua. The peaks are a powerful presence, rising abruptly and radiant in the morning light, the deep clefts in their flanks robed in lush vegetation. Dominating the range is Kala, a 4,025 feet, the highest mountain on Oahu. I see the peak again during lunch in Halawea, and old sugar town that moves to a Bob Marley shuffle these days and has no lack of places to buy a surfboard or an acai smoothie. I'm sitting with Milton Agutter and Al Madreno at a picnic table over the Red Barn Farm Stand, a roadside stand and outdoor cafe. As we tackle hefty smoked brisket sandwiches, the two sun-burnished farmers talk about the days of King Sugar in Waialua before the mill closed in 1996. The whole economy ran on sugar, says Agutter. He and Madrina worked a combined 45 years on Dole Food Company's Wailua Plantation. Though sugar had been planted here as far back as 1865, production really took off around the time a railway linked the North Shore with Honolulu in the late 1890s. By that time, waves of immigrant sugar workers, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Portuguese, Filipino, and others, along with longtime Polynesian inhabitants, were already forging modern Hawaii's unique cultural identity. Growing sugar meant plowing, planting, fixing irrigation pipes, burning the fields, cutting the cane, and hauling it to the mill, continues Agata, a Kauai native. It was hard work, but you know, I miss those years. We were younger and stronger then, laughs Madrina, who as a kid immigrated from the Philippines to Oahu with his widowed mother, a laborer in the pineapple fields. Even before Dole finally laid us off, we'd already started growing vegetables in our spare time on 6 acres we leased from them. 17 years later, their Twin Bridge Farms now covers 300-plus acres and specializes in seed corn, potato seed testing for mainland states, and tender asparagus snapped up by top island restaurants. Agata, age 74, admits to taking it easier in recent years, traveling for pleasure and business, while Madrina, who is 62 and runs the farm's day-to-day operation, says he slowed down too. But they don't strike me as the types to ever simply hang it up. In fact, the Red Barn is their latest project, only recently opened. In an unusual twist, it is run by other farmers and showcases the produce of many local farms, not just Twin Bridges. We'd like this to represent all of us growing food on the North Shore, says Agata, and we hope it becomes a gathering spot. During my week on the North Shore, I meet others trying to keep the country on a former sugar land. At Kahuku Farms, a 125-acre commercial operation with a shady farm stand cafe and tractor-pulled wagon rides, I chat with family members of the owners, descendants of Japanese sugar workers, while enjoying a sweet tart ilikoi, passion fruit cooler, and grilled panini plump with mozzarella and fresh veggies. Afterward, I stop at a roadside stand to buy small bags of fuchsia-fleshed dragon fruit from farmers who grew it on 468 acres managed by Turtle Bay Resort, which only months earlier were permanently dedicated to agricultural use. At Mohala Farms, a popular stopover for young people from around Hawaii and beyond eager to exchange their labor for organic farming experience and a place to stay on the North Shore, I see the traditional Hawaiian thatch roof pavilion, or hale, where sold-out farm dinners take place. In Halewa, I rendezvous with cocoa grower Seneca Klassen, hop in his dusty pickup, and bump along a red dirt road to his 14-acre orchard about 500 feet above the town. There we walk past trees with dirigible-shaped pods of yellow, red, and purple hanging from branches. Klassen breaks open one pod to reveal big, slime-covered seeds, cocoa beans, that he will dry and ferment before roasting and transforming into his Lona Hana brand chocolate in a Honolulu warehouse. This farm has been an amazing journey, says Klassen, a lean, articulate man who was part owner of an Oakland, California chocolate cafe before moving to Oahu. With years of sugar cultivation having turned the soil into an inert clay mixture, he explains, his team has used tons of organic matter to reinvigorate it. When I started planting in 2009, I didn't really understand the concept of Malama Aina, he says. I was focused on something specific, cocoa, that I wanted out of the land. But over time, I've realized that my important work here is to care for this little spot, which will be around long after I'm gone. Yes, we're growing cocoa, but we're also remaking this into the forest it would have been in the old times. One Saturday morning, I make the 5-minute drive from Halewa to the town of Wailua for the small but lively outdoor produce market of a co-op whose members farm small plots set aside by Dole for displaced sugar workers. The market takes place at the defunct sugar mill, and on my way, where I pass the town's modest houses and a city park with a bandstand next to venerable banyan trees. A large sign proclaims, Wailua, home of the world's best sugar. The market is in full swing when I arrive around noon, with perhaps 100 shoppers and a dozen vendors who sell everything from kale and papaya to soursop poi and prepared foods such as sticky rice and huli huli chicken hot off the grill. I walk around the mill grounds, where in the few remaining rusted metal buildings, I come upon a soap maker, surfboard shapers, and facilities for processing the coffee and cocoa beans that Dole grows on the North Shore under its Wailua Estate brand. Late that afternoon, I hike near Dillingham Ranch, a historic 2,700 acres of equestrian grounds, polo fields, one of Hawaii's largest coconut tree groves, and a restored lodge, now used as a private event center. The hike starts flat but soon climbs steeply into the foothills of the Waianae Range. An hour later, I stand at a vista point looking out over the Wailua District. I see the old sugar mill smokestack in the foreground, monster-sized white wind turbines along a distant ridge, and technology, both past and present, and a checkerboard of fields that once were an uninterrupted sea of cane. Many fields have clearly gone to guinea grass, a tall, invasive weed, but a fair number look cultivated, and they make me think of something I heard earlier that day at the market from a land conservation manager I met. "We're still figuring out what the agricultural landscape will be," he said. "Progress may be slow, but we're making it." Not everyone I meet is a farmer. I hike for half a day with Kahokule's Huku Haiku, a native Hawaiian, Kahu cultural practitioner, and trail guide who was born on the North Shore and has an intimate knowledge of its paths, valleys, and hidden waterfalls. We start at the site of Oahu's largest old Hawaiian hau, or temple, Pu'umokuka, which overlooks Waimea Bay. A rectangular platform outlined in a stacked black volcanic rock, it is thought to date from the 1600s. "Wailua was the Mar-a-Lago of old Hawaii," says Haiku. "Most of the island's chiefs and chiefesses had a place here, and Waimea Valley was home to powerful priests." Before we start back, Haiku asked me to join him in an ole, a blessing. As I repeat after him, he prays to gods and ancestors and thanks them from our hearts. We close with the Hawaiian phrase meaning with love, chanted three times, once each to the past, the present, and the future. Aloha'i, aloha'i, aloha'i. The day before leaving the North Shore, I drive along a dirt road that runs through the open fields outside Halewa. There I stumble on the grass-choked ruins of a 19th-century Catholic church built of volcanic rock and later used by the sugar workers, now buried beneath simple crosses and stones in the graveyard. It is a haunting reminder of the past, and yet I am also aware of the sounds in the distance that signal hope for this beautiful land. I hear a tractor rumble to life at nearby Mahala Farms, and from a roadside stand beneath mist-covered koala, the joyful laughter of a young worker rings clear. Well, travel-wise, Oahu is a sidebar that Christopher Hall's article has, and it offers readers some tips about visiting Oahu if you're interested. When to go? Well, the North Shore's famous waves are at their most towering and powerful during the winter when important surfing competitions are held. From May through September, the water is calmer for swimming and snorkeling. How about where to stay? Well, Turtle Bay Resort, the main and only resort on the North Shore, fosters a low-key vibe throughout its 850 acres, which include pools, restaurants, a spa, and about 5 miles of coastline. Activities include kayaking in protected Koala Bay, home to green sea turtles. And you can learn more about all this at turtlebayresort.com, turtlebayresort.com. West Oahu, I should say. Most of the other hotels in Oahu are in Waikiki, or the new and quickly developing Keolina area of West Oahu. Properties here include Disney's Alunae and the new Four Seasons Resort Oahu. How about where to eat? Well, Wailua Bakery and Juice Bar on the main drag in Halewa. The laid-back beach shack of a bakery serves deli sandwiches, baked goods, and juices and smoothies made from fruits grown on the bakery's own organic farm. Try the tangy sweet soursop smoothie. And you can learn more at waialuabakery.com. WaialuaBakery.com. And then we have Halewa, or Halewa Beach House, and that is spelled H-A-L-E-I-W-A, Halewa Beach House. This airy modern dining room features garage door walls that slide up to let in the trade winds and a view of the ocean. And you stop here for craft beers, cocktails, poo-poos, appetizers, or fresh, local fresh dishes, fish dishes. And HalewaBeachHouse.com has more information for you. Halewa, H-A-L-E-I-W-A, HalewaBeachHouse.com. Then there are farm stands, Kahuku Farms, K-A-H-U-K-U, Kahuku Farms. You can find more than fresh fruit and vegetables at this farm stand. Take a wagon ride tour, eat the outdoor cafe, and buy prepared food such as the farm's Iliqui, or passion fruit, and with balsamic dressing is what is recommended. KahukuFarms.com has more details for you online. KahukuFarms.com, K-A-H-U-K-U, Kahuku Farms. Then Red Barn Cafe. This farm stand features the produce of local growers. The cafe offers breakfast burritos, wraps, and other lunch fare. It also sells prepared foods and periodically offers cooking classes, farm tours, workshops, meet the farmer meals, and live music. Check it all out at RedBarnFarmStand.com, RedBarnFarmStand.com. Wow, what a trip, huh, that would be. Well, we leave Oahu, and the final stop in our series, Best of the World, Where to Go in 2018, from the December 2017, January 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Now we're going to enjoy some luxurious train travel from Belfast to Cork, written by Patty Nickell of the Lexington Herald Leader, published in the December 24, 2017 issue of the News and Observer. There is something about trains that captivated me since childhood. Maybe it's the general rocking back and forth as it crisscrosses the country. Maybe it's the mournful sound of the train's whistle in the night. With its promises, places yet to be seen, and perhaps best of all, its knowledge that I'm not squeezed into a seat on a plane. Alas, living in the United States, I'm not able to indulge my passion for trains much, which makes it all the more wonderful when I'm somewhere where I can. That most recent somewhere was Ireland, and the train wasn't your common garden variety type, but the Belmont Grand Hibernian. Officially launched in August 2016, the Grand Hibernian is a sister train of other Belmont acquisitions, the Venice Simplon Orient Express and the Royal Scotsman. Often referred to as country houses on rails, they embody the very essence of luxurious train travel. I left Dublin's Euston Station for a two-night Taste of Ireland tour north to Belfast on the first day and south again to Cork on the second. But there is also a four-night Lofts and Legends, or the two itineraries can be combined for a real Irish adventure. I found that many of those on board didn't really care where they were going. It was the train itself that was the appeal. Limited to just 40 passengers and with a multinational staff dedicated to fulfilling your every wish, it seems like one giant house party on wheels. Just name your pleasure in the observation bar car, and the genial bartenders can whip up everything from specialty cocktails using gunpowder gin to Manhattans and whiskey sours for bourbon lovers such as myself. About the only thing they can't conjure up is the lifeblood of Ireland, Guinness on tap, as there is no room for kegs, but they do have a supply of drafting cans. Well, there you go. A train trip in Ireland sounds like a lot of fun, doesn't it? Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you'll listen next time that you've enjoyed your journey today. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and reminding you our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, with the broadcast readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.